Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Hello, you are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the November 17th, Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. City agrees to police reform by Elise Schmelzer, the Denver Post. Health agencies urging mandate by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. In GOP majority appeals court to consider vaccine rule by Jeff Mulvihill, the Associated Press. Consent decree between Aurora, Colorado Attorney General. City agrees to police reform. Plan calls for changes in hiring, training policies by Elise Schmelzer, the Denver Post. The Aurora Police Department will enact changes to its use of force, hiring, and training policies as part of a multi-year agreement with the state's top law enforcement official, the Colorado Attorney General announced Tuesday. The Colorado Attorney General's office and the leaders of the Aurora Police and Fire Departments agreed in a legal document known as a consent decree to make changes to a wide breadth of policies and practices. The decree announced by Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser on Tuesday, one of the first in the country enacted by a state official, followed an investigation by the Attorney General's office that found a pattern of racially biased policing and routine use of excessive force in Aurora. The city shall change in measurable ways how Aurora Police engages with all members of the community, including by reducing any racial disparities in how Aurora Police engages, arrests, and uses force in the community, the decree states. Aurora is required to hire an outside consent decree monitor to track progress on the requirements. The monitor will also engage the community around the changes and give final approval to any policy changes made by the agencies while the decree is in effect. The monitor will have full access to Aurora Police and Fire documents and will regularly report progress, or lack thereof, to the judge overseeing the decree. The decree is expected to last approximately 5 years. Aurora leaders will have 2 years to change policies and procedures and will then undergo monitoring for an additional 3 years. Weiser and Aurora City leaders emphasized that the creation of the decree was a collaboration. If city officials had not cooperated, Weiser could have forced them to adopt changes through the courts. We're in this work together, Weiser said during a news conference Tuesday. We're not going to shy away from reform. The consent decree is the first enacted after the passage of the Colorado lawmakers in 2020 of a police reform bill that gave the Attorney General the authority to conduct pattern and practice investigations into how law enforcement agencies in the state conduct themselves. A handful of other state attorneys general have the power to implement consent decrees, Weiser said, though they are typically mandated by the U.S. Department of Justice. The investigation conducted by the Attorney General is one of many enacted after protests of police brutality and racism in the 2020 highlighted death of Elijah McClain, who had died the previous year in Aurora police custody after being violently arrested and injected with the sedative ketamine. They heard your cry and they came and they did an investigation into this agency, Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson said of the Attorney General's office. And I can tell you that we're not going to shy away from reform. The changes required by the decree in Aurora focus on use of force, police stops, use of sedatives by paramedics, hiring, and discipline. The agreement requires the police department to track use of force incidents and conduct complaints more closely in order to detect patterns and make policy and training changes as needed. Aurora Police will be required to develop and implement training that focuses on what officers should do instead of what they legally can do. Aurora Police will also undergo training on combating bias, avoiding escalation, and keeping precise and accurate records on police interactions. The city shall create a culture of enforcement that prioritizes de-escalation when possible in accordance with Colorado law, but does not compromise officer safety when force must be used, the decree states. The city shall improve and develop accountability measures that consistently identify excessive uses of force, situations where force should not have been used, even if it was legal, and recurring training and tactical issues related to use of force. The police department already contracted with the Boston-based Crime and Justice Institute for a review to improve their use of force policies, the decree states. The Institute's experts will look at policies related to deadly force, investigations of use of force, and working with people with mental health needs. The consent decree monitor will track the number of severity of use incidences as well as officer and community complaints to evaluate the success of the reforms. The police department will also be required to create new policies on when officers can legally stop someone and provide practical guidance on exercising that discretion. Outside experts hired to investigate the death of McLean found the officers who stopped the 23-year-old as he walked home from a convenience stop had no basis to detain him. Reviewing drugs used to restrain people. The agreement forbids Aurora Fire Rescue from starting the use of ketamine without approval from the consent decree monitor. The fire department halted the use of the sedative in September 2020, and Chief Fernando Gray said Tuesday the department doesn't plan to reinstate the use of the drug, though paramedics do use a different sedative, Verst. Aurora Fire Rescue paramedics injected McLean with a too large dose of ketamine while he was in custody. The paramedics who injected him were indicted on homicide and manslaughter charges in September, along with the police officers involved in McLean's arrest in connection to his death. Aurora Fire Rescue must also create a process to review all drugs used to restrain people in the field and how those incidents are resolved. The monitor will then look over those reports for other potential issues. The decree will require the city to rework its hiring process for police and firefighters. It requires that the departments be more involved in the early stages of the hiring process and have the final say on which candidates are hired. The city's Civil Service Commission currently handles all stages of hiring up until a candidate is assigned to the training academy. Both Aurora Fire and Police Departments will be required to create a written recruitment plan that outlines how the agencies will recruit and hire a more diverse workforce. The city will also have to hire an outside expert on hiring a diverse public safety workforce. The consent decree also requires the city to change its disciplinary process and substantially reduce the amount of time it takes for such cases to conclude. The Civil Service Commission, which hears appeals of disciplinary decisions, will also be required to make as many proceedings as possible easily accessible to the public. The Aurora City Council on Monday will vote on the resolution approving a consent decree. City Manager Jim Twombly said, the decree will then be filed in Arapahoe County District Court and signed by a judge. Reform work will continue even as the city solicits candidates for the decree monitor. The monitor will likely cost Aurora hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, Twombly said. It's going to be expensive, he said. Biden's mandate on employers. GOP majority appeals court to consider vaccine rule. by Jeff Mulvihill, the Associated Press. Challenges to President Joe Biden's COVID-19 vaccine mandate for private employers will be consolidated in the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, a panel dominated by judges appointed by Republicans. The Cincinnati-based court was selected Tuesday in a random drawing using ping pong balls, a process employed when challenges to certain federal agency actions are filed in multiple courts. The selection could be good news for those challenging the administration's vaccine requirement, which includes officials in 27 Republican-led states, employers, and several conservative and business organizations. They argue the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration does not have the authority to impose the mandate. The challenges, along with some from unions that said the vaccine mandate didn't go far enough, were made this month in 12 circuit courts. Under an arcane system, it was up to the clerk of the judicial panel on multi-district litigation to select a ping pong ball from a bin to choose where the cases would be heard. It was a favorable outcome for Republicans. 11 of the 16 full-time judges in the Sixth Circuit were appointed by Republican presidents. Accounting for one of the Republican-appointed judges, Helene White, who often sides with judges appointed by Democrats, and adding senior judges who are semi-retired but still hear cases, the split is 19-9 in favor of Republicans. Six of the full-time judges were appointed by former President Donald Trump. Another court where a majority of judges were nominated by Republicans, the New Orleans-based Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, issued a ruling that put the mandate on hold. It's not clear whether the court will hear the case, will act as the Fifth Circuit did and side quickly with the Republican challengers. But legal experts have become increasingly concerned in recent years about the politicization of both federal and state courts, raising questions about whether justice is fairly administered or dispensed through partisan lens. Allison Orr Larson, a professor at William and Mary Law School, co-authored a study published this year that found growing partisanship in federal judicial decisions. For decades, the study found that rulings on cases in which all judges in a circuit weighed in general were not decided along party lines based on the presidents who appointed the judges. We did see a concerning spike starting in 2018 that led us to wring our hands, Larson said in an interview. The increasing partisanship in a branch of government that is supposed to be blind to partisan politics was seen in judges appointed by presidents of both parties, but Larson said it's clear why that was, said it's not clear why that was or whether it will last. Some of the federal courts moved to the right when Donald Trump was president and Republicans control the U.S. Senate, which confirms judicial nominees. Trump appointed 54 judges to the circuit courts, which are one step below the U.S. Supreme Court, including filling one seat twice. That represents nearly 30% of the seats on circuit courts where cases were most often considered by three-panel judges. Trump's appointees flipped the 11th Circuit Court in the South to Republican control and expanded the GOP-appointed majorities in the 5th, 6th, and 8th Circuits in the Midwest and South. Biden's three appointees switched the New York-based Second Circuit to Democratic control. Republican state attorneys general and conservative groups mostly filled their challenges in circuit courts dominated by conservative judges, while the unions went to circuits with more judges nominated by Democratic presidents. In all, 34 objections have been filed in all 11 regional circuits, plus the one for the District of Columbia. That's where the ping pong balls came into play. Under federal law, cases challenging federal agency actions get consolidated upon the agency's request if they are filed in multiple circuit courts. Each circuit where a challenge is filed within the first days of the agency taking action has an equal chance of being selected. It was up to the judicial panel's clerk, John W. Nichols, to select a ping pong ball from a bin, according to a Tuesday court filing by the panel. The office denied a request by the Association Associated Press to allow media access to the drawing. Previously this year, the lottery had been used to assign just two cases. The employer vaccine mandate calls for businesses with more than 100 workers to require employees to be vaccinated by January 4th or wear masks and be tested weekly for COVID-19. Exemptions are provided for religious reasons and for those who work at home or only outdoors. COVID-19, health agencies urging mandate. Letter calls for Polis to require across the state face coverings, vaccine passports, by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. A group of Metro public health agencies has urged Governor Jared Polis to issue a statewide mask mandate and vaccine passports in indoor settings because of a surge in COVID-19 in the state's hospitals. The Metro Denver Partnership for Health sent the letter to Polis and Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment Executive Director Jill Ryan on Friday. The group includes Boulder County Public Health, the City and County of Broomfield, Denver Public Health and Environment, and the Public Health Institute at Denver Health, Jefferson County Public Health, and Tri-County Health Department, whose directors signed the letter. The health officials called for requiring proof of vaccination for patrons and staff in indoor areas considered high risk, such as bars, restaurants, gyms, sporting events, and other large group gatherings, and for requiring face coverings for those ages 2 and up in public indoor settings that don't require vaccine passports. Implementation through mitigation strategies is urgently needed in conjunction with expansion of access to no-cost monoclonal antibody treatments and other actions that relieve the health system to protect Colorado's already compromised hospital capacity, the letter stated. These requirements must be statewide, given the statewide nature of Colorado's shared hospital ecosystem. Polis has resisted issuing another statewide mask mandate. The last one mostly ended in May, and in July had declared Colorado's state of pandemic emergency over. But case counts in Colorado have since increased, and hospitals have warned that the latest COVID-19 surge could require medical care to be rationed. As noted in the letter, Polis has said the entire state is now considered high risk, and that he encouraged all adults at least 6 months out from their completed vaccination to get booster shots. In an interview with Face the Nation on Sunday, Polis answered questions about implementing health restrictions by saying businesses have put in their own measures and that COVID-19 is most dangerous to those who are unvaccinated. Last week, he cited New Mexico's case counts as similar to those in Colorado, despite its mask order. In a statement to the Denver Post on Tuesday, Governor's Office spokesperson Connor Cahill said the governor believes in the science that proves vaccines are the way to end the pandemic. "We are laser-like focused on increasing vaccinations, scaling the administration of monoclonal therapies, and building more hospital capacity," Cahill wrote. "The governor is always a willing partner to support local actions tailored to local circumstances, such as mask policies, and was happy to successfully lead a regional approach to make large indoor settings safer. He also pointed to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's order amended earlier this week that requires people to show proof of vaccine at unseated indoor events of 500 or more people in 6 Metro Denver counties starting November 19th. But public health officials from the Metro Denver Partnership for Health argued in their letter that though they agree vaccines are the best way to get out of the pandemic, more is required, especially with lower numbers of vaccinated Coloradans in some part of the state. Mask mandates have been proven effective. The most recent modeling report from the Colorado School of Public Health identifies immediate increases in transmission control measures, such as mask wearing, as a strategy for reducing future hospital demand, it states. The letter notes that 6 states have these statewide orders, and all of them, aside from New Mexico, have case rates that are lower than Colorado's. Dr. Bill Berman, Executive Director of the Public Health Institute of Denver Health and former MD-PH co-chair, said on Tuesday that it's always possible to find an example to make a point someone wants to make. But more broadly, the data is clear that masking reduces transmission. Plus, even in countries with high vaccination rates, they are still struggling with transmission of Delta variant. So this could serve as another measure of prevention, he said. The agency's directors also asked POLIS to require vaccines without allowing for regular testing to replace getting them for several sectors across the state, including staff and volunteers in schools and licensed childcare settings, as well as shelters and other congregate living facilities, healthcare providers who don't already have mandates, and all state, county, city employees and those serving on boards and commissions and elected councils and contractors. In addition to the threats to hospital capacity, the current surge more broadly threatens our schools' abilities to remain open and in person, our region's continued economic recovery, and the health and safety of all Coloradans, the letter stated. We urgently request your leadership in responding to this crisis. Berman says he hesitates to use the word crisis, but it's warranted with the COVID-19 situation in Colorado. In addition to shortage of available hospital beds, medical providers are seeing early cases of influenza and more social gatherings are expected with upcoming holidays and travel. He believes if the mask and vaccine orders are implemented, Colorado could see a reduction in case counts within 2 weeks. There are businesses in Colorado already requiring proof of vaccination at their events, and it's been used as a successful intervention around the country and world, Berman said. This type of measure is a way to work with the business community rather than shutting businesses down, he added. No one thinks these are going to be easy steps to take, he said. We certainly don't, but we think they're necessary. Estes Park, Wildfire Forces Evacuations Amid Dry, Windy Conditions, by Shelley Bradbury and Noel Phillips, The Denver Post. Estes Park. Sarah Hastings and Zoe Karam woke Tuesday to see fire bellowing over a mountain near the 19 acres where they live in a motorhome off U.S. 36 in Larimer County. Ordered to evacuate, they packed up the motorhome, a travel trailer, a utility trailer, and several motorcycles, moving everything into Estes Park and out of the wildfire's path. Luckily, we are RVers, so we could get our whole home out, Karam said. The fire the pair fled from forced mandatory evacuations in several neighborhoods south of Estes Park on Tuesday. The Kruger Rock Fire grew to about 133 acres after it was first reported around 7 a.m. near Little Valley Road and Fish Creek Road, according to the Larimer County Sheriff's Office. The fire was 15% contained Tuesday evening. Meanwhile, the Larimer County Sheriff's Office confirmed it was investigating reports of a single-engine air tanker crashed south of Estes Park late Tuesday night. The Sheriff's Office said its office and other agencies were searching the area where the crash was reported, which was around the area of the Kruger Rock Fire. A Denver 7 crew spotted a plane flying shortly after 6 p.m. However, it's unclear if the plane involved in the reported crash. A crew member on the ground confirmed to Denver 7 that a plane was down and they were trying to figure out how to get to it. The late-season blaze took some residents by surprise, but Colorado has experienced longer wildfire seasons in recent years, with fires more frequently burning in the fall and winter amid long-term drought and a warming climate. Fire knows no season, says Captain Brenda Finnegan, Wildland Fire Coordinator at the West Metro Fire Protection District. Fire doesn't know what time of the year it is and whether we should be watching the Super Bowl or skiing. If conditions are ripe and ready, it's always dangerous. Climate change has extended summer's warm temperatures and delayed snowfall, creating a longer fire season, said Adam Mayhood, a postdoctoral researcher at Earth Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. The trend has been building in Colorado for the last decade, he said. Maybe 20 years ago, we would have definitely been covered by snow by now, and the snow is coming later and melting sooner, he said. Windy and dry conditions fueled the Kruger Rock Fire Tuesday, Larimer County Sheriff Justin Smith said. The fire may have started from a spark on power lines or a power transformer during strong overnight winds, he said. A fire investigator was looking into those reports. Blustery winds made it too dangerous for aircraft to fly in the mountains and too unpredictable to send firefighters on the ground Tuesday, Smith said. About 150 people were called in to work the fire. The wind on Tuesday blew the flames away from homes in the Little Valley neighborhood, Smith said. Fire crews shored up the back end of the fire to protect the neighborhood should the wind change directions, he said. The wildfire threatened structures, but no damage was reported by Tuesday evening. Mandatory evacuations were ordered for the areas of Little Valley, Hermit Park, Meadowdale, Big Elk Meadows, and Pinewood Springs. US 36 was blanketed in heavy smoke for several miles and was closed between Lyons and Estes Park. The Estes Park Event Center at 1125 Rooftop Way served as an evacuation shelter Tuesday, as well as the Life Bridge Church at 10345 Ute Highway in Longmont. The YMCA at 2515 Tunnel Road in Estes Park was available for overnight stays. Small animals could be evacuated to the Larimer Humane Society at 3501 East 71st Street in Loveland, officials said. Large animals could go to the ranch at 5280 Arena Circle in Loveland. About a dozen people gathered at the shelter location in Estes Park, where local businesses provided pies, pizza, burritos, and junk food to evacuees. They were relaxed, and several said they knew what to do Tuesday morning because they experienced evacuations in 2020 during the East Troublesome Fire, a blaze that started on October 14, 2020 and burned more than 193,000 acres before it fizzled. Tom Musselwhite said he woke at around 6:25 a.m. Tuesday and built a fire to warm the house when he realized he didn't have electricity. His daughter, Debbie Goldwater, woke about an hour later when her brother called to tell them about a mandatory evacuation in the area. I got up and dressed as quick as I could. I grabbed my purse and the dog and we left, Goldwater said. We knew not to wait, Musselwhite said about receiving notice to evacuate. Fire crews came to their door shortly after his son called. The evacuees were encouraged to hear winds were blowing flames away from their Little Valley home, but they worried about the electricity going out. Freezing temperatures overnight could cause their plumbing to burst. We're hoping to get power restored before too long because we worry about freezing pipes, Musselwhite said. By early evening, Estes Park officials announced power had been restored to the Little Valley and Rockwood Estates. Joe Atterbury, who evacuated from his home in Pole Hill, said he'd been hoping to make it through 2021 without a fire evacuation. I thought I'd make it through this year, but no, Atterbury said. Officials sent out mandatory evacuation notices to 317 contacts and voluntary evacuation notices to 1,149 contacts, Larimer County Sheriff's Office spokesman David Moore said. That number is likely higher than the actual number of people evacuating because a single person can sign up to receive multiple notifications and be counted as multiple contacts, he said. Much of the Front Range was under a red flag warning Tuesday, though the area where the Kruger Rock Fire burned was not covered by that warning. Finnegan, the West Metro fire captain, said his department no longer considers summer to be Colorado's fire season, just the peak of the season. We're continuing to watch a growing trend with fires pretty much every month of the year, he said. We definitely have our peak times, which is in Colorado, June through August, but it's crept up into the fall, and now it's creeping up into winter. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Alice C. Ashmore, November 30th, 1930 to November 10th, 2021. Kind, beloved mother and wife, eternally loved by family and friends. A graveside service will be held in her honor on Friday, November 19th, 9:30 a.m. at Fort Logan National Cemetery, staging area B, 3698 South Sheridan Boulevard, Denver, 80236. Barbara L. Covillo, May 4th, 1937 to November 12th, 2021. Services will be held at Archdiocese of Denver Mortuary on Friday, November 19th, 2021. There'll be a rosary at 8:30 a.m., followed by a funeral mass at 9 a.m. Bridget Rita Donovan, January 14th, 1953 to November 9th, 2021. Funeral mass at Horan and McConaty, 1029 South Colorado Boulevard, Denver, 11 a.m. Friday, November 19th, for full obituary at horancares.com. James T. Jim Nowski, Sr., 1937 to 2021. Visitation November 20th, 2021, 3 to 6 p.m. Olinger Crown Hill. Services November 27th, 2021, 12 p.m. Westminster Elks Lodge. Potluck to follow. Arsia Grisenti Martelon, born December 19th, 1934 in Denver, Colorado. Died in her home, surrounded by family November 1st, 2021. To accommodate most family members, rosary and celebration of life services to be held at a later date. Instead of flowers, please consider donation to the National Jewish Hospital ILD program or Blessed Sacrament Church. Illa Prouty Gable Venerable, November 6, 1936 to November 15, 2021. Isla Prouty Gable Venerable Adams of Denver County passed away in her home November 14, 2021. Isla is preceded in death by her mother, Elva Y. Adams, and father, Winfred Prouty, sister, Jan Vale, and husbands, Bill Adams and Cliff Venerable. Survived by brothers Roy Knight and Jerry Knob, sister Peggy Knight, husband John Gable, daughters Kim and Colette, son Bill, grandchildren Derek and Spencer, and great-granddaughter Sadie. A life celebration will be held at Stony Brook Clubhouse, 4601 South Yosemite, Denver 80237, Friday, November 19th at 2 p.m. Donald A. Don Snyder, July 23, 1943 to November 5, 2021. Funeral mass on Friday, November 19, 2021 at 11:30 a.m. with a rosary beginning at 11 a.m. and viewing at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary Magdalene Roman Catholic Church, 2771 Zenobia Street, Denver, Colorado. Burial at 1:30 p.m. at Mount Olivet Catholic Cemetery, Wheat Ridge. For full obituary, please visit horancares.com. Fidelia L.C. Valdez. Fidelia L.C. Valdez, 79, of Littleton, passed away on November 11, 2021. She is survived by her loving husband, Roberto Jim Valdez. Visitation will be Thursday, November 18, 2021, 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m., Horan and McConaty Family Chapel, 3101 South Wadsworth Boulevard, Lakewood. Rosary and Mass will be held Friday, November 19, 2021, at 9:30 a.m., Notre Dame Catholic Church, 2190 South Sheridan Boulevard, Denver. Burial will be held at Fort Logan National Cemetery. For full obituary, please go to HoranCares.com. Francis Sonny Visaki, January 31st, 1939 to November 7th, 2021. Francis Jerome Sonny Visaki, spirited and loving husband, father, grandfather, great-grandfather, son, friend, and so much more, left his world peacefully Sunday evening, November 7, 2021, at age of 82, joining his wife Carol of 59 years in heaven. Our profoundly protective, loving, and dedicated Francis was lovingly surrounded by his children, their spouses, and grandchildren at his home he had built for his family and lived in for 47 years. They all surrounded him with love, compassion, and caring during his final days. He is missed deeply. Francis Jerome Visaki was born on January 31st, 1939, in Eno, Wisconsin, to Paul Visaki and Mary Visaki, maiden name Hudak. He lived on the family farm with his four sisters and parents until his father's death in 1951, when Francis was only 12 years old. His mother moved the family into town to Ashland, Wisconsin, where he continued developing his role of a protective brother and loyal son to the women in the house. He filled that role seamlessly and was extremely close to all of his sisters throughout their lives. He graduated high school in 1956 and went on to attend college in Ashland at Northland College, where he studied mathematics. Sonny became restless in the small town of Ashland and decided to head west to experience the big city in Denver, Colorado, where his aunt, uncle, and cousins lived. He met his beautiful, loving, happy wife, Carol Jean Swan, through his cousin, Noma, while in Colorado. It became clear very quickly that they were meant to be together forever. They married on July 21st, 1962. Together, they raised four adoring children in Parker, Colorado. He is survived by many loving family members, including his daughter, Lisa, and her husband, John Bromley, and son, Patrick, and his wife, Anna Liss, his son, Michael, and his wife, Trina, his daughter, Nada, and her husband, Russ Farmer. His grandchildren include Megan and husband, Rocky, Alred, maiden name Bromley, Angela and husband Paul Rizovic Bromley, Sean Visaki, Evan Visaki, David Visaki and fiance Aubrey Imbriani, Ashley Visaki and fiance Kyle Pocalco, Brenda and wife Carly Austin, Jeffrey and wife Brittany Austin, and Dylan Austin, his great-grandchildren Andrew, Lillian, Maximus, Abigail, Miles, Felix, Bryn, Duke, Arabelle, Hazel, Hunter, and Parker. A funeral service is scheduled for 11 a.m. on Friday, November 19, 2021, at St. Thomas More Catholic Church at 8035 South Quebec Street in Inglewood, Colorado, 80012. For further details, please visit pfhco.com/obituary/Francis-Visaki for further details. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Controversy over video. House to vote on censuring Rep. Gosar, by Kevin Freeking and Lisa Mascaro, the Associated Press. Washington. The House will vote Wednesday on a resolution to censure Republican Rep. Paul Gosar of Arizona for tweeting an animated video that depicted him striking Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democratic New York, with a sword. Democratic lawmakers said Gosar's actions amounted to threatening another member's life, calling the video so beyond the pale. Republicans warned Democrats to be careful about dictating the punishment of those who serve in the minority because of the precedent it will set. Earlier this year, the House stripped Rep. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican in Georgia of her committee assignments for spreading hateful and violent conspiracy theories. This is a dark and dangerous road the majority is going down, said Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma, the ranking Republican on the House Rules Committee. I urge you for the future of the chamber to rethink this course. Gosar posted the video over a week ago with a note saying, any anime fans out there. The roughly 90-second video was an altered version of a Japanese anime clip interspersed with shots of Border Patrol officers and migrants at the South U.S. border. During one roughly 10-second section, animated characters whose faces had been replaced with Gosar, Green of Georgia, and Lauren Boebert of Colorado were shown fighting other animated characters. In one scene, Gosar's characters is seen striking the one made to look like Ocasio-Cortez in the neck with a sword. The video also shows him attacking President Joe Biden. Last week, Gosar issued a statement saying the video wasn't meant to depict harm or violence, calling it instead a symbolic portrayal of a fight over immigration policy. He told his House Republican colleagues during a private meeting Tuesday that he would never espouse violence or harm to anyone. Gosar noted that he took the video down from his account, according to a person in the room who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the private meeting. Ocasio-Cortez said he has not apologized to her. It's been well over a week. He not only has not apologized, she said, he not only has not made any sort of contact or outreach, neither he nor the Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, but he has also doubled down by saying that I am somehow, you know, representative of undocumented people. The resolution coming up for vote states that depictions of violence can foment actual violence and jeopardize the safety of elected officials. The House has censured its members on 23 occasions. The last censure resolution was approved in 2010 involving Democratic Rep. Charles Rangel, the former chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee for Financial Misconduct. The censure resolution also calls for Gosar's removal from the two committees he serves on. Casa Bonita, venue hires a big-name chef. James Beard nominee Dana Rodriguez looks to upgrade menu. By Josie Sexton, the Denver Post. Much of the speculation on the future of Casa Bonita and its trademarked terrible food is now over. On Tuesday, three-time James Beard-nominated Denver chef Dana Rodriguez announced that she's now leading the kitchen at the Lakewood Entertainment Destination. The restaurant will reopen under Rodriguez's culinary leadership, and under new owners, South Park creators Matt Stone and Trey Parker, sometime in the second half of 2022, Rodriguez said. I've been working in the restaurant for about 2 weeks now, she told the Denver Post on Tuesday, and I've started thinking how to make everything better in my own way. Rodriguez is the chef and operator behind beloved Denver restaurants Work and Class and Super Mega Bien. She also has her own mezcal brand, Doña Loca, named after an affectionate nickname for the chef within the local industry. She's known for her candor, sense of humor, and down-to-earth approach to running restaurants. Rodriguez and her partners are transparent about finances with employees and both pay front and back of house workers better than Denver restaurant standards. One of the things that made me say yes to the partnership so quickly is how these guys approach their employees, Rodriguez said of Stone and Parker. Casa Bonita is not a playground for them. They own it because they can afford to and they can make it better. The new partner's motto for making it better, Rodrigo added, is how can we change nothing and improve everything? That means keeping Casa Bonita the fun family destination it's always been, but also creating a food and drink menu from scratch, including better expletive enchiladas and even fresh homemade, hand-made tortillas. It's also going to be fun for the adults, too, to have good food and fresh drinks, she said. And for those who are concerned about the future of Casa Bonita Sopapillas, often considered one of the restaurant's few palatable dishes, I would not do it without the sopapillas, she added. That's one of the things we promise to people. Rodriguez is currently working with around 60 former Casa Bonita employees and plans to hire 30 or so more in the short term. Some of the workers have been around since the 70s and they wanted to still work here, Rodriguez said. Summit Family Restaurants, Casa Bonita's longtime owner and the company that sold the business to Stone and Parker, came under scrutiny at the start of the pandemic over reports of unpaid wages. Rodriguez said she hopes to create a family of the large staff that will be working together every day, every night, once the restaurant reopens. Partnering with Matt and Trey is one of the biggest things that's happened in my life, she said. It's a dream come true to get to know that there are people out there who try to help communities and to do the right thing and to work with them. The partnership is also personal. In 1998, when Rodriguez first came to Denver from her native Chihuahua, looking for work, but without any formal restaurant experience and knowing very little English, she applied at the West Colfax Institution. Rodriguez figured she'd be in good company with fellow Spanish speakers and in a Mexican kitchen. But whoever interviewed her at the time said she wasn't qualified for a position. 23 years later, plus two successful restaurants, a mezcal company, and a few national award nominations under her belt, she's excited to get to work. Oil and gas. Coming off climate talks, U.S. to hold huge crude sale in Gulf, by Matthew Brown and Janet McConaughey, the Associated Press. New Orleans. The U.S. Interior Department on Wednesday will auction vast oil and gas reserves in the Gulf of Mexico, estimated to hold up to 1.1 billion barrels of crude, the first such sale under President Joe Biden, and a harbinger of the challenges he faces to reach climate goals that depends on deep cuts in fossil fuel emissions. The live stream sale invited energy companies to bid on drilling leases across some 136,000 square miles, about twice the area of Florida. It will take years to develop the leases before companies start pumping crude. That means they could keep producing long past 2030, but when scientists say the world needs to be well on the way to cutting greenhouse gas emissions to avoid catastrophic climate change. The auction comes after a federal judge in a lawsuit brought by Republican states rejected a suspension of the fossil fuel sales that Biden imposed when he first took office. The Democrat campaigned on promises to curb fossil fuels from public lands and waters, which, including coal, account for about a quarter of the U.S. energy-related emissions. Yet even as he's tried to cajole other world leaders into strengthening international efforts against global warming, Wednesday's sale illustrates Biden's difficulties gaining ground on climate issues at home. The administration last week proposed another round of oil and gas leases in 2022 in Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and other western states. Interior Department officials proceeded despite concluding that burning the fuels could lead billions of dollars in potential future climate changes. We had Trump's unconstrained approach to oil and gas on federal lands and Biden's early attempt to pause drilling. Now it looks like the Biden administration is trying to find a new policy, said researcher Robert Johnston with Columbia University Center on Global Energy Policy. They're being very cautious about undermining their fragile momentum on climate issues, he added. The Energy Bureau said in pre-sale documents released Tuesday that it received bids on 307 tracts totaling nearly 2,700 square miles. That's the largest total for a single sale since Gulf-wide bidding resumed in 2017. Those seven sales have generated almost $1 billion in total revenue. Environmental reviews of the Gulf of Mexico sale conducted under former President Donald Trump and affirmed under Biden reached an unlikely conclusion. Extracting and burning the fuel would result in fewer greenhouse gases than leaving it in the ground. Similar claims in two other cases in Alaska were rejected by federal courts after challenges from environmentalists. Climate scientist Peter Erickson, whose work was cited by judges in one of the cases, said the Interior Department's analysis had a glaring omission. They left out greenhouse gas increases in foreign countries that result from having more Gulf oil on the market. The math is extremely simple on this kind of stuff, said Erickson, a senior scientist with the Stockholm Environment Institute, a nonprofit research group. If new leases expand the global oil supply, that's a proportional effect on emissions from burning oil. Therefore, giving out these leases in the Gulf of Mexico would be increasing global emissions. The Interior Department's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in recent months changed its emission modeling methods, citing Erickson's work. But officials said it was too late to use the new approach for Wednesday's lease sale, which they said had been through a rigorous process with specific timelines. The environmental analysis for lease sale 257 was already complete and as such does not contain the newer approach to considering the impacts of foreign consumption of oil and gas, the agency said in a statement provided to the Associated Press. Administration officials declined AP's interview request for upcoming sales. Spokesperson Melissa Schwartz said Interior is conducting a more comprehensive emission review than any prior administration as it appeals the court order and that forced their resumption. Eric Melito, president of the National Ocean Industries Association, said he was uncertain that using the new approach would have changed the government's conclusion, since drilling for oil in other parts of the world is less efficient and hauling imports also adds to carbon costs. He described the Gulf as the backbone of the U.S. oil production and said companies considered it a strong investment. The continued use of the old analysis rankles drilling opponents who say Biden isn't following through on his climate chip pledges. We're talking about transitioning away from a fossil fuel economy, and they are selling a giant carbon bomb of a lease sale, said attorney Drew Caputo with Earth Justice, which has a lawsuit challenging the Gulf's lease sale pending in federal court. That creates a property right to develop those leases. It's a lot harder to keep the carbon in the ground if you sell the lease. Some Democrats also objected to the sale. The chairman of the House National Resources Committee, Arizona Rep. Paul Grijalva, and said Biden promised to lead on climate issues but continues running a fossil fuel program with a long history of mismanagement. The administration needs to do better, Grijalva said in a statement Tuesday. The Gulf of Mexico accounts for about 15% of total U.S. crude production and 5% of its natural gas. Industry analysts had predicted some heightened interest in Wednesday sales since oil prices rose sharply over the past year. It's also a chance for companies to secure drilling rights before the administration or Congress can increase drilling fees and royalty rates or adopt new restrictions on environmental permits, said analyst Justin Rostand with industry consulting firm Wood Mackenzie. An outright ban on new leases and drilling seems unlikely after the federal court shot down Biden's temporary suspension, he said. Different companies have different approaches and different strategies, Rostand said. Some could think this might be the year to go big. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
A new report identifies the areas most valuable for preserving biodiversity and fighting climate change within the Grand Mesa, Uncompahgre, and Gunnison National Forests, which are managed as a unit commonly known as GMUG. Researchers with Conservation Science Partners identified the top 10% of areas of high ecological value. Report co-author Justin Siracci says he hopes the data will guide the U.S. Forest Service, which is working on a new forest plan for the area with input from stakeholders, including tribes.
They have to revise how they're managing the forest in terms of places that they will designate for resource extraction or motor vehicle use versus setting places aside for biodiversity conservation, etc.
People can find the draft proposal and submit public comments on the U.S. Forest Service site now through Friday, November 26th. Local groups are submitting a joint community conservation proposal for consideration. It's online at gmugrevision.com. Mike Berkeley, an outdoorsman from Paonia in the North Fork Valley, says he's glad places like the top of Mount Lamborn made the list.
It's known to be one of the best habitats for black bears in Colorado, and it's got a lot of elk, deer. Great solitude, incredible scenery, and it's a very important water source for our valley.
Scientists looked at multiple criteria to select the areas of high ecological value, including the amount of carbon they sequester above and below ground and the number of imperiled species. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Colorado News Connection, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times. On this Veterans Day, the nation honors those who served in the military, now about 19 million people, including Tim Keefe.
When I swore into the Navy in Boston, I was ready and willing to give my life for this country. And it seemed like during this time, I couldn't even get a sandwich from them.
Keefe testified about his struggles with food insecurity during a House hearing Wednesday. After he suffered a work injury and became homeless, Keefe received food assistance benefits, but was cut off after 3 months when he couldn't meet job requirements.
Unfortunately, I can tell you firsthand that when you have gone a couple days without food, your whole being cries out for it. The desperation I can't explain.
Homelessness is another challenge faced by about 40,000 veterans. CEO of the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans, Catherine Monet, says the Build Back Better plan includes significant investments to address the problem.
When I say significant, I mean truly game-changing, right? $25 billion in rental assistance, $15 billion for the Housing Trust Fund, and $455 million for the NHAPS Use Lease Program.
And during a White House ceremony honoring veteran caregiving families, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said there's a new effort to better support military families in transition.
Our military families make us a stronger, a healthier, and a more ready force. So we have to make sure that our phenomenal military families can not only survive the hard times, but they can actually thrive throughout their service.
President Joe Biden will deliver Veterans Day remarks at Arlington National Cemetery and participate in a wreath-laying ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, marking its 100th anniversary. Biden highlighted the recently passed $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, which he'll sign Monday.
This bill is going to reduce the cost of goods to consumers, businesses, and get people back to work, helping us build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out, that where everybody's better off.
Biden expects rising prices to fall once supply bottlenecks ease. U.S. consumer prices rose more than 6% in the past year, the fastest annual pace since 1990. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is considering legal recourse in response to allegations the federal government sent 70 planes carrying migrants from the southern border to Jacksonville this summer. He also threatened to shuttle buses of migrants to President Biden's home state.
I will send them to Delaware and do that. I mean, if he's not going to support the border being secured, then he should be able to have everyone there.
A key source of information for the Steele dossier, Russian policy analyst Igor Danchenko pleaded not guilty to 5 felony false statement charges. He's accused of providing false information to the FBI, investigating ties between Russia and the 2016 Trump presidential campaign. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
Hadley Institute for the Visually Impaired introduces a new online discussion group called Resource Roundtable. Searching for resources specific to vision loss? Have some to share? Join our resource roundtable to discover and share tips for connecting to the information and support you are looking for. The facilitators are Hadley Learning Experts Steve Kelly and Debbie Warman. Continue to learn and share with Hadley's Resource Roundtable Discussion Group on the third Wednesday every month. Call into the discussion at 1-929-205-6099. The meeting ID is 437-585-202. Learn more about Resource Roundtable at hadley.edu/discussions or call 1-800-323-4238.